Hey, Rich Lowry here. If you're like me, you're a last-minute Christmas shopper and a terrible gift wrapper, but let me make this easy for you. You know the gift everyone wants? It's a better night's sleep. Boll & Branch never disappoints with the highest quality sheets, blankets, pillows, and throws. Plus, their holiday packaging makes your gift look and feel special. I got to tell you, Boll & Branch sheets meet my standards, but much more importantly, they've met my wife's standards. Husband and wife team Scott and Missy Tannen founded Boll & Branch to create a new standard in bedding by doing things the right way, not the easy way. Boll & Branch holds themselves to high standards across the board, from sourcing pure organic cotton to putting workers' rights first. And it's not just their sheets that are made the right way. Their pillows, bath towels, and robes are too. So treat yourself and your loved ones to the new standard in bedding from Boll & Branch. Their gifts come wrapped and ready in their special holiday packaging. Order by December 19th for guaranteed delivery by Christmas.
Shop the holiday semi-annual sale from December 9th to December 15th and get 20% off
at ballandbranch.com. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com. Exclusions may apply. Please check it out.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Capitol Record. This is David Bahnsen. I'm the host of Capitol Record, and I am the author of the new book, There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths, and I'm throwing that out there because I want to. And I'll tell you, I love week by week with Capitol Record talking about the things that I wrote There's No Free Lunch about. I do the podcast. I wrote the book for the same reason. These are all the issues I care most about in the whole world. And hopefully the guests we're having on that I'm conversing on various issues with are scratching the itches you care about as well when it comes to the elements of a free society, our defense of free markets, and so forth. Our guest today is an absolute warrior in the cause. I got to meet him in New York City. I've been reading him for many years, but I got to meet him and enjoy a very nice long breakfast meeting in New York a couple weeks ago. His name is Ryan Anderson, and you may be familiar with him. He had been a senior research director at the Heritage Foundation for a long time. He was well-known writer, author, scholar. He did his PhD at Notre Dame in political philosophy and is an absolutely incredible author. And yet recently has become the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. So Ryan and I both spoke at the Napa Institute's conference in New York in October, and since then have enjoyed some correspondence and conversation that made it very clear to me he'd be an outstanding guest here on Capitol Record. So we're going to bring Ryan on right now and just start talking about the great issues today that center around markets and virtue. So with that said, welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record, and welcome our guest today for the first time on Capitol Record, Ryan Anderson.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
Ryan, it's a pleasure to have you. I have been excited about this talk for a little while. You and I both shared the stage at an event in New York City a couple months ago, and I've been excited to have you on Capitol Record ever since then. I think that there are growing amounts of issues in current, you know, dialogue on the right, and particularly even within the church, on how we approach markets. And since I met you and we got to converse that week and share stage at the conference at Napa Institute, I happened to read some stuff that you had written some time back in response to John Miller's book, Redeeming Economics. And you wrote sort of a two-part review at the public discourse. I was really taken, and I mean this sincerely, by your command of those issues, which even for John writing the book were very complex and somewhat novel, but just profound and insightful. And I feel that it might be helpful if maybe you gave listeners a little overview of what this concept that we talk about is, the triple A approach to economics, not just for Catholics. I think that there's a sort of historical paradigm that's really interesting. Maybe we could dive into that a little bit.
Sure. So the book in question, it was John Mueller, who's now, you know, one of my colleagues at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I guess he published it about a decade or so ago with ISI Books, titled Redeeming Economics. I was then the editor-in-chief of Public Discourse. I wrote a two-part review of it there. And if I got the timing right, I think I was still a graduate student at the University of Notre Dame working on my PhD in political philosophy with a focus on, you know, some economic questions. And what John does in that book, which I think is really helpful, is, you know, that AAA approach to think about economics coming from Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas, right? Those are the three A's. Some people then will frequently add a fourth A with Anscombe, right? Elizabeth Anscombe kind of carries on the Aristotelian, Augustinian, Thomistic tradition in the 20th century. But what John points out is that what's missing from a lot of contemporary economic thinking is thinking about final causality, ends, goods, you know, the purposes, and therefore the distribution, right? How should we think about how we deploy our resources as producers, as consumers? You know, what are the ends that we should be seeking? That to a certain extent, much of modern economics takes that as a starting point, that people just have preferences, they have things that they desire, they have a utility preference curve, et cetera, et cetera. And then they just map that on to see, like, well, what are the empirical outcomes? John wants to take a step back and say, well, as a normative question, what should we be pursuing in our market activities? You know, what should we be producing? What should we be consuming? How should we be distributing scarce resources, et cetera, et cetera? And he thinks that's the missing piece to much of modern economic analysis, is that it's been purely a positivistic science, purely descriptive, purely, you know, when I say positivistic, I mean, you know, positing an empirical reality, studying an empirical reality, rather than also thinking as a normative matter, you know, not what is the case, but what should be the case, what ought to be the case. And then you get the question of how do those things intersect? How do they dialogue? And it's a question of kind of, you know, how both ethics and economics come into conversation with each other.
Do you think that if that effort that John was sort of striking at around a decade ago, if there would be more prescriptive intentionality from those of us who are defenders in a largely high level context of free markets and free enterprise, that some of the controversies that we're seeing now and almost sort of skepticisms about what they're fond of calling market orthodoxy. And I think here of the Orrin Casses and Sourabh Amaris that have concerns about where not just the liberal order at large, but particularly the notion of free and what they like to call unfettered markets are creating. Do you think that Mueller's idea of more prescriptive intentionality at the distribution function out of utility, that it would address those things in a way that would kind of reposition that conversation?
I think so, because I mean, I am not fully where either Sourabh or Orrin are, but I appreciate, you know, many of kind of the insights and the criticisms that they've leveled. And look, and sometimes, you know, they've been critics of mine. So it's not even sometimes friendly, sometimes, you know, not so friendly. But I mean, I'm kind of a big tent person here where I think that I want to learn from them. I want to see what they're putting forward. And I think you're right in suggesting that John, you know, a decade ago was also getting at many of those same set of concerns. And I think the American political tradition at its best was getting at that. But there really was a turn within the past several decades in which freedom, rights, liberties, GDP, those concepts crowded out concepts of virtue, morality, goodness, and truth. And that the American political tradition at its best always had both. Right, we talked about rights and responsibilities.
And when you're referring, I want to be clear, to the political tradition or the economic tradition. In few decades, do you think this concern is in the political side or economic or both?
I would say both. And to a certain extent, it's a political economy question that the Reagan Revolution saw that in the aftermath of the New Deal and the Great Society and various other both like big government welfare programs, but also heavy-handed regulatory schemes, an agenda that had lots of deregulation and lots of focus on getting the government out of the way and freeing up entrepreneurs, freeing up private enterprise, was an appropriate way of titrating things. That, you know, we had gone too far in one direction. We need to come back. And I think now the concern is, have we gone too far in the other direction? I'm not convinced that that's the root cause of the problems, partly because I don't think we've been living in like a libertarian paradise over the past 30 years. Like, you know, the guys at Cato, you know, didn't get their agenda fully enacted. They're just as frustrated with the state of affairs as the rest of us. Yeah. But I do think what we've seen is that people who command large outsized market power have not always exercised it in ways that are conducive with human flourishing, with human dignity, and with the common good.
Well, and that seems indisputable to me that has taken place. I think the reason I was wondering if it was the larger political tradition or a more narrow economic tradition that's been the focus of a greater secularization, the focus of a kind of reordering of priorities, and that is largely focused more on, as you say, GDP or other metrics that were somewhat bifurcated from virtue, is I think that on the economic side, it's easier to identify. I think that most on the right have been very proud to say that they are Randian, that Ayn Rand became kind of the torchbearer, and that it seemed to me that we had more Burkean roots for those of us in the political tradition. But I think that if there was anyone who had kind of an appreciation for Aristotle on how these things benefited a city state and how free enterprise was compatible when it was most coupled with an enlightened self-interest, I think it was Burke. And so now if you talk to young people that are zealous about free enterprise, I don't know if they know who Burke is. And you're very right that the starting point, see, I want to get to GDP too. I want to get to growth. I want to get to output and productivity. But they start with these econometrics, and the notion of the human person is not at the root of how they think about free enterprise. But the thing I struggle with in Moore's work, which I thought was just absolutely outstanding, is he's just so hard on Adam Smith. And I'm just not sure that Adam Smith wouldn't be there with us on this. When you couple theory of moral sentiments with wealth and nations, I think that he wasn't explicit in the distribution function, but I'm not sure that he would find anything we're saying uncomfortable.
And I think that could be right, that while he himself didn't fully integrate theory of moral sentiments with wealth of nations, that they could be integrated. And that might be, you know, some of the work that someone like Sam Gregg is trying to do, some of the work that Michael Novak tried to do back when he was with us. And it's the work that, you know, John Mueller was doing a decade ago in that book. And I think that's the project moving forward, right? Yeah. Because I mean, even the concern here is, I mean, take something like GDP, and that first word there is gross, right? Next word, domestic, right? That doesn't tell us anything about how the median worker is doing or how the median family is doing. You could have your gross domestic product go way through the roof while having, you know, median family income, median worker wages stay flat. And I don't think any of us would be satisfied with that outcome, because I mean, what that would suggest is that the way that you grew GDP was on the upper tiers of a distributional curve.
But can I point out, I think something obvious here. It would be a necessary but not sufficient condition if we want everyone to experience human flourishing. It's safe to say that that can't happen if no one is experiencing human flourishing. And so while many experiencing it doesn't address the few, maybe the median worker, maybe other categories, our goal would be the tide lifting all ships. But we at least have to include the aggregates. Because if all the aggregates are dropping, it's safe to say that nobody's doing well.
Yes. So it's an even worse outcome would be if GDP went down.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, maybe not. What if GDP went down only because millionaires and billionaires did not do particularly well?
That just couldn't. It couldn't happen.
You're just saying empirically. So, but I mean, as a thought experiment, you could have a situation in which, like, blue collar workers, their income, their earnings, their quality of life went up. So the bottom of that distribution scale went up, the top stagnated or went down, and therefore the average, the gross domestic result there would be one.
Yeah, I think as a thought experiment, we could put in numbers into a spreadsheet, but in real life, it couldn't happen based on what we know about output, what we know about incentives, what we know about profits, what we know about reinvestment, what we know about return on invested capital. It would be economically impossible, but as a thought experiment, morally, how would we feel? But I do think that there's a risk in going down that thought of even a sort of Marxian class divide, that we think about, well, how do we get it so that these different income groups are, I would prefer to think still in the context of human flourishing applied to the way I think God thinks about it, all of humanity. Right. And it is true. It is somewhat unnecessary for me to sit around worrying about the plight of the billionaire. But if I define flourishing in a material and spiritual context, which I do, I actually do care for the billionaire. I'd like them to have greater flourishing. I think there's a lot of very unhappy billionaires.
Yes.
And so we want to be non-materialistic in the way we think about helping the poor and in the way we think about serving the rich.
But I mean, just to stay on the thought experiment, because then I do want to, you know, get to kind of a more kind of, you know, in actuality, these thought experiments don't happen. Just, you know, as you said, given the nature of the profit motive and the price signal and the way that profits impact and, you know, the way that kind of capital is directed and reinvested, the thought experiment's purely an experiment. But I mean, I do think there's a argument to be made that, in terms of human flourishing, the millionaire or billionaire could see an increase in flourishing with a decrease of their net worth. That many of us, I mean, I just speaking personally, have made decisions where our paycheck went down, but our family flourishing and our interpersonal flourishing went up.
Sure.
And, you know, I think, you know, we probably all have to make decisions on a regular basis of, is it worth, you know, doing another trip to do another event where, you know, it'll be a paid event, but it'll be another night away from home, another, you know, missed family occasion. And we make the trade-off on, you know, less income, but more family time.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that's just to say, even at the thought experiment level, I do think you could have a situation in which GDP is not the appropriate metric for flourishing just as such.
I think GDP is not the appropriate metric for flourishing for the same reason that any singular metric will not be, because of its singularity.
Yeah.
That it will always be useful, but will always be limited by the very thing you're describing, that it captures one thing and there are many things that we want to be capturing when our objective is as total as human flourishing is. Because of the wide scope of flourishing, any singular metric will be inadequate at capturing it. But I think that your point about the way in which so many on the economic right and political right have gone over the last 30 years, I still do question, as a man of faith, if it is any more complicated than just the secularization that we naturally migrated. You can have a secular left, and that's certainly what most people spend most of their time worrying about these days. Understandably, you and I are both in that camp, and a lot of cultural issues, economic ones, etc. But I guess a growing secular right that is open to a limited government, and in fact fervent about such a cause, and yet divorced from the notion of morality in the culture, ethics. And of course, the concept of individual virtue and responsibility, I don't believe any of us would want to see that outcome when we come at it from the faith perspective we do. But I think that when you go back, what Miller did is so interesting is extract a lot more meat off the bone of what we can learn from Aristotle, particularly Augustine on utility, and just the sort of reordering of how we understand people at the as the object of our loves, of our passions. I think free enterprise people do often think that people love a car instead of understanding that they love a car because of the utility it brings them or perhaps somebody else, you know, but that there's a person as the object of these utility function, I think is incredibly important way to understand it. And I could read Augustine extensively on it directly, but it was reading Miller on Augustine that really fleshed it out for me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that you just said there to kind of respond to. I think one is that you're exactly right. It's the Ayn Randification of support for markets and liberty that I think then led to the past several years of a counterbalance. And I think that's a healthy counterbalance. And of course, it can be overdone. And so, you know, the important question is like, you know, how to get the pendulum to swing. You know, Aristotle says that a virtue is the mean between two extremes. And, you know, so if Rand was one, you know, virtuous, vicious extreme, there's another extreme. And we want to find what the virtuous mean is. The second thought is, you know, Ross Douthat had famously said, if you don't like the religious right, just wait to see the post-religious right, because it's going to be worse, right? I mean, so, you know, his point was to, you know, secular progressives is like, if you guys are worried about evangelicals and Catholics in politics, wait to when the Republican Party no longer has that moral and spiritual footing and what'll happen to it. And I think that's exactly right. And again, you can see an extreme between a secular left-leaning liberalism and a secular right-leaning liberalism. And, you know, we want to avoid both of those extremes.
And so this is, I guess, where, and I think you and I stay connected on this point, but where I share this really big concern for a lot of our friends that are right now skeptical of markets, but what I think they are skeptical of and should be skeptical of is, in fact, the other side. It's the secularization efforts, the humanistic approach, and then, of course, the fruit from that tree that they don't like. Perhaps it is disregard for the median wages of a worker. Perhaps it is cronyism. There's a number of things they could point to. And I would share their concern for a lot of the issues, maybe not all of them, but most I would. But yet I think that the cause and effect gets distorted, because I believe the concern is a lack of religious foundation, a lack of philosophical coherence, that sort of epistemological basis in society. And they seem to be going straight to the symptoms, which are in markets, where I believe markets as an instrument for freedom and virtue are kind of the innocent bystander here, but they're being blamed for some of the outcome that, in fact, the secularization within the sphere of markets has created. I'm probably oversimplifying things here, but how do we not throw the baby out with the bathwater, which is what I fear some of our friends, particularly on the Catholic right, are doing right now?
Yeah, I think that's a valid question. I mean, a couple of thoughts would be, markets themselves are just kind of the end results of lots of human interactions, right?
Or one human interaction. One of my favorite spot things, market, two human beings on an island, and that's it. You're going to have a market in about 1 second.
Yep. And then the only question should be, well, what sort of human interactions are in keeping with human flourishing, right? And so there are some things that money shouldn't buy, right? There are certain things that we shouldn't have markets in. And this is something that, you know, every now and again, Reason Magazine will have a cover story, or Cato will come up with a report saying, you know, we should have markets in sex, right? Legalized prostitution, sex workers is a property. Look, there are some things markets we shouldn't have, right? We shouldn't have markets in sex. We shouldn't have markets in killing. We shouldn't have markets in human beings, right? And this is why we say, you know, no to prostitution, no to the buying and selling of babies, no to the owning of human beings with slavery, no to assisted suicide, things like this, right? We can see that there are certain things, certain interactions, certain actions that are inherently contrary to human dignity, to human flourishing, to the common good. I mean, however you kind of want to, within your particular moral tradition, you know, spell out what makes those things wrong. And we don't want to have markets in them. Then it strikes me there are other things where we do want to have markets, but we also need to then think about, well, what are the appropriate conditioning of the market, regulations of the market, or just kind of structuring of the market? Because, you know, markets don't exist in a pure state of nature, right? Property rights are something that need to be concretized. And so, you know, in a variety of ways, let's say in a residential neighborhood, there are going to be limitations of how you can exercise your property rights. And some of those are made explicit, right? So there might be covenants. You can't paint your house pink. You can't blast loud music after, you know, a certain time at night. Some of them might only be implicit. You don't use the leaf blower on a Sunday morning, right? There's not a, you know, there's not a law about that, but there's an implicit understanding that even though you might technically have a legal property right to be mowing the lawn at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning, you know, it's not virtuous. It's not neighborly to do those sorts of things, right? And so the simple example of the residential neighborhood is going to have parallels, you know, all throughout our market interactions. And that's where I think someone like Oren is trying to get us to think through, all right, well, what are the appropriate structuring mechanisms? What should that look like? And then I would just say there's a third set of questions of, let's say your God-given gifts and talents and how you've cultivated them up to this point, the value of your labor on the current market, given all of the givens, is X. And I have to use hand gestures. So David, you're going to see this and no one else listening to us, yeah, and this is eventually published will. But let's say, you know, given all the givens, you have certain God-given gifts and talents, you've cultivated it to a certain extent, and it's worth X on the market. Your labor is worth X. But your genuine needs, right? Genuine, we're not talking like superficial. Genuine needs are why. How do we close that gap? And that strikes me as an important question to wrestle with. Because if you are a market person and you say, look, we're going to have a market in labor and my labor is worth this amount, but my genuine needs and my family's genuine needs is above that, you know, there are different ways of thinking about how you close the gap. Like, you know, one is to try to increase the value of your labor on a market. Another is to try to lower the cost of your needs. Doing both, finding various supplements to bridge the gap in the meantime, preferably without distorting markets. And then I think Oren wants to suggest structuring markets so that those things meet a clearing point.
And I guess
to my mind, the types of things that people are wrestling with now.
Let's say that we were not talking with someone of good faith around a lot of these issues. We were not talking with someone who we know well, hold in high regard, have read other material, have a background and pedigree. And we heard the language from a professor, from someone in a faculty lounge at a left-leaning American institution of higher learning, that we needed a central planner to help us fill the divide between X and Y, that there are people whose needs are higher than their sustenance. And they came about with a series of solutions that were just simply textbook. Now, they could be good or bad. It deserves a hearing. I happen to think it's been getting a hearing for over 100 years, so I don't think it's particularly new. But if their prescriptions were all various forms of wealth redistribution, of regulation, of increased central planning, when you use the term order markets, that Cass would like to see us find a way to order markets in a way that helps regulate that, I think that we would assume we were talking with someone who was paradigmatically opposed to our view of markets and enterprise. Now, that isn't the case here. There is some good faith. There is some benefit of the doubt and so forth. And yet I think that a lot of the language opens up the door of ambiguity. Is it possible to have the conversation that you want to have, that I want to have, that Oren wants to have, about those whose genuine needs are higher than the market demand for their labor? I think that's a good way to summarize this. And to start off the conversation without central planning on the table.
Yep. Yeah.
Or started off with a repudiation of the Nirvana myth.
Yes.
That not try to play into a right-wing utopianism that we can get this perfect any more than we want to hold on to the view, the left-wing utopianism that central planning can get it perfect. Is that, that I guess to me would be so beneficial to the cause to sort of limit some things off the top.
Well, that is a great follow-up question because, I mean, so to be honest, the first, I think probably three quarters of the way I described that situation, in my mind, I was actually riffing off of Hayek, right? And so think about, you know, Hayek has those famous footnotes where he says, you know, there's no reason in a developed advanced society like ours where we couldn't have certain welfare programs, provided they take place outside of the market and that they don't distort the market. And so you can think of another kind of free market person like Friedman, who was, you know, to my mind, you know, the innovator of the school choice movement with, you know, something like vouchers, mm-hmm. saying, all right, well, let's say you're a family and your genuine educational needs are Y, you know, your income's X, we could help close that gap by allowing you to send your kids to the same schools that the law partners send their kids to. And, you know, the way that we're going to do it is not through central planning. It's not through government run schools. It's by giving you a direct financial support for you to then choose what school to send your kids to. Right. So I don't even think necessarily we need to think about this in terms of central planning or government program, apart from, you know, if you think a voucher program is, you know, in a certain sense, it's obviously a government program. But what's been interesting to me is that even most libertarians are in favor of school choice, right? They don't say that it's, you know, there's a certain type of libertarian who says all taxation is theft. But taxing you, David, and then giving some of your money to the family that lives in Anacostia so they can send their kids to a better school, to my mind, that's an improvement of the current situation, which would
be. Yeah, but I'm a just absolutely fervent defender of school choice. Wrote a whole chapter on this subject in my first book, Crisis of Responsibility. Friedman, you're right, is sort of a forefather in a lot of it. But I still believe that almost every defender of school choice has the gift of starting the discussion with the presupposition that we live in a tax-driven economy that is funding a public school system. So the question becomes, with taxes already being directed towards the school system, how can we democratize that and liberalize that to allow for a greater outcome for a greater number of people? The discussion of school choice would just become kind of illogical if that weren't the case. And so it's more to me, I think, about the descriptive reality of the system we have.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a good question. If we didn't have government-run schools, so let's say we didn't have, you know, the schools that we call public schools, the government-run schools, children who are born to poor parents, they still deserve to be educated, and we have duties to see to it that they are educated. You know, maybe in an ideal theory, you would say
when you say we, Ryan, are you referring to the church or the state? Or the family. Well,
that's where I'm going to get to. Is
okay, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Maybe, no, it's fine. Because you could say, I mean, the first person that has responsibility of those children is going to be the parents, right? So let's say my wife and I have kids. You know, we have the primary obligation and therefore also the primary responsibility to see to it that they're educated. If we can't fulfill that task, you know, let's say we're both, you know, let's say my wife and I, neither of us graduated from high school ourselves. And so, you know, our labor is not particularly valuable on the market. You know, we're making what we're making. We can't fully fund the education of our children. The next sphere of support would be our extended family. It would be our local community. It would be our church. I mean, I guess one question for you would be like, I mean, do you think it ever gets to the point where there's a role for the political community to step in? Or do you always think that, you know, civil society and charity will be enough?
Well, I would say this, where there is a potential role, whether we're talking about education or other needs-based, you know, general welfare functions, where those things, because I am very Kyperian about this, as it sounds like you were, in a sphere sovereignty, as long as we're starting with family, going to extended family, going to church, and then we discuss where in the totem pole of needs being met, the potential for political community enters, I still would be exclusively in the domain of local government. And this is not just our shared doctrine of subsidiarity. It is also an efficiency argument. It is a Hayek knowledge problem argument. It is the legitimacy in function. I simply see no function at all for the federal government to make decisions on how somebody in Middleton, Ohio is educated. And yet, if there is a need for that political community to play a role, I think it would be the democratic function of city council, local school district, things that really flow out of a subsidiarity function in that local environment.
Yeah. So I mean, I was not thinking of like a federal government voucher. I mean, as far as I know, there is not a federal, you know, K-12 voucher or school choice program. That all of the existing school choice programs at the K-12 level are state-based and, you know, sometimes even more municipal-based.
Which is interesting because there is significant federal funding since the Department of Education for local school districts. They're even though it is not a large percentage relative to state funding, there is significant federal funding for local public schools. But you're right. Even Secretary DeVos's efforts to see some federal support of school choice was not met well.
Yeah. But so all of which is to say is that, I think there is a conversation to be had purely on the Hayekian Milton Friedman grounds of, you know, if there is that gap, how do you close it? And one would be, you know, what are ways in which we can increase the value of the labor?
I'm sorry, Ryan, I'm interrupting on purpose because I do think you're accidentally doing something that I want to make sure we're clear on. You had talked about Cass referring to the value of labor and the needs, and there was a sort of market delta. But then when you talked about Hayek, you appealed to his case for the extreme social safety net, which was basically destitute, impoverished people. Are we talking about people that are members, that are economic actors in society who are earning below what their need is? Or are we talking about the most destitute among us to go to a kind of class divide? Are you talking about lower middle class or even middle class, which is really Cass's great passion? Or are you talking about what Hayek was referring to, which I think is sort of the bottom decile of economic capability? Do you think that's a fair distinction?
It is. But, I mean, so I think the answer to your question is we're talking about both, although, I mean, we should think about them in different ways. I mean, one is a purely kind of like anti-poverty discussion, and another might be more of a kind of like family formation and family flourishing discussion that you know, some of our welfare programs are, you know, they were originally designed like literally to help people get off the streets. But then I think there's an additional discussion, and I don't see any reason in principle to say that, you know, the only role for public policy should be anti-poverty, that, you know, provided you're not destitute, you know, that's where the state stops caring about economic conditions. And it's been a while since I reread that Hayek. But I mean, my memory of this was he was talking about something that might look like Medicaid and Medicare, right? And Medicaid and Medicare are different, right? I mean, so if you think about it, like, Medicaid is kind of a program for, you know, low income, like the bottom decile in the way that you described it, whereas Medicare is more or less for anyone over the age of 65, right? And it actually seems, from what I understand on this, and I'm not a health policy expert by any means, is that Medicare actually works a lot better than Medicaid. That, you know, many doctors say that, you know, you're better off being uninsured than having Medicaid. They don't accept Medicaid, blah, blah, blah. Whereas many seniors are pretty happy with their Medicare. And so it may even be in this case that, you know, the anti-poverty health program that we created doesn't function as well as the old age healthcare program that we created. I think in both cases, they were probably structured in much too status of a way, right? I mean, so when you talked about like central planning and government-run programs, I mean, it strikes me that if the innovation that Friedman had for education policy was school vouchers, healthcare vouchers, and things like this might be a much better way of thinking about healthcare reform. You know, rather than having single payer healthcare, rather than having government run healthcare, empower more people to compete on the market for healthcare. In the same way, it's very Kuiperian to say, you know, when it comes to education, empower more parents to be able to exercise authority over the education of their kids, rather than funding schools, right? Funding government-run schools, fund students. You know, have the money follow the student, and then allow the parent to decide where they want to send their child to school. Again, this is, you know, taking the status quo as a starting point. Right? I mean, I think whenever we're talking about law and public policy, there's that temptation to do the ideal theory, where, you know, wouldn't it be? But in practical reality, you know, given where we are, where we're spending, you know, I forget what the exact, you know, figure is. It's, you know, 1 point something trillion a year on federal mean tested welfare programs. How should that be structured? Right. And so anyway, this is to go back to your question from a while ago. Like, that was one part that was animating the way that I described that situation, is, you know, how do you close that gap? Are there ways of lowering the costs through market efficiencies? Are there ways of increasing the value of my labor by making me a more valuable worker, right? Are there, you know, direct subsidies, healthcare vouchers, school choice vouchers that could help you close the gap? And then it strikes me that Orrin is then asking a different question of saying, well, are there ways in which we could actually structure the labor market from the get-go so the gap doesn't exist, right? And that's where I think that, you know, you probably have more of your concerns about what that would look like practically speaking.
I actually would have concerns about how it might look practically, but I do candidly have a concern with the sentence.
Okay.
How can we structure the labor market? And I don't think it has to be problematic once one is graciously allowed to unpack it, depending on how they unpack it. But yeah, I think there needs to be a natural skepticism, because how we structure the labor market most certainly has at least a loose implication of central planning.
Yeah. Well, it could. I mean, I have not read everything. I've read Orrin's book, but I haven't read everything he's written since then. I mean, my understanding is that, you know, he's much more interested in not government central planning so much as what are the rules of the road that should be the starting points for the sorts of contracts that we form in the labor market, right? So if you think about, we have rules of the road, what should the speed limits be? Which side of the road do we drive on? You know, can you drink and drive, right? None of us think those things are central planning, right? None of those things are telling us, you know, what our destination should be, what type of car we should drive, you know, when
we should drive. So they're in the legitimate function of government.
Yeah, and so I think Orrin wants to ask the question of what sorts of, what are the comparable parallels when it comes to labor contracts and when it comes to labor markets? So, I mean, here's an example. You know, some of the larger like warehousey corporations, someone like Amazon or Walmart will sometimes do what's known as like just-in-time scheduling, mm-hmm. where you're not given a, you know, regular job schedule. That could be very hard on family life, right? Because as a parent, if day to day, week to week, your job schedule is up in the air, you know, should we allow that? Yes or no, right? I mean, I don't think there's any.
Should we allow that refer to the scope of a regulatory disinterested third party? Or does it refer to what we believe as individuals in the community is best practice, both in terms of efficiency and care and virtue? And I think the problem with it is it puts a little gravitas behind it. It seems more modern. It seems more contemporary. It seems more, there's a little more sophistication that it's referencing. It isn't like we're using a coal miner analogy from the 1800s. And yet the principle of the government having a qualified opinion on whether or not scheduling limits and so forth makes sense. Because my answer would be that could be bad for a given family in a given case, just as the company eliminating it and therefore eliminating 10,000 jobs could be bad. Whereas perhaps like a doctor being on call provides some labor for a young student residency and they don't have guaranteed work, but they're available. Maybe just-in-time scheduling has a market function that the employer and the employee see in their time and place circumstances, to borrow from Hayek, that I don't see, and that most certainly Washington, D.C. doesn't see. And so that's where I think that the base, we kind of have a gift we've been given of certain principles. And I don't believe that we need to say, once we have those principles and we put them in our pocket or put them in the drawer, that all modern application just means there's no new need for hand-wringing and no new need for earnest discussion. Healthcare, education, you've brought up great examples of where there is that need. But when we get into a case where we say, okay, here's a case that could have a problematic labor application, and see government could come in and eliminate just in time or regulate just in time, my presupposition is that them doing it is going to do more harm than good. And I think there's pretty clear evidence of that historically. And then philosophically, it's already been made clear to us by things I'm not willing to abandon. Knowledge problem, price mechanism, and so forth. And so that's where I'm trying to figure out, are we all on the same page? And there's just maybe one leans a little more here, leans a little more there. Or are we looking at actually discounting some of those old principles because we're just saying the modern economy has gotten a little too hard for Hayek?
Yeah, no. So I think that's really good. I think what Oren would say, and it's weird.
You're becoming Oren's lawyer. Oren, yeah.
I think he would say that there are trade-offs. I'll just put it in my own voice. I think there are trade-offs here.
Sure.
And
there's no free lunch.
as Friedman said. It strikes me that what you just said is that you have a disposition to think that in almost every circumstance, the trade-off would actually be counterproductive. It would go against human flourishing, that the state regulation is actually going to do more harm than good, partly because of the knowledge problem, that we won't actually know all of the things that we are trading off ahead of time, right? And so we can't even kind of like factor for and account for all of those things. Now, I think on the other side, you would say, but look, there are some things let me give you an easy case, child labor. There were probably economic costs to us saying that children under a certain age can't work. And we didn't know what all those costs would be. There were also benefits. And here it was much more of like a moral argument that we said, children deserve to have a certain time and space to develop, including an intellectual development, before they turn into market actors, and that childhood is a time and a space for play and joy and education and formation, et cetera, et cetera. And then where you draw that line, right? What is the age? That's a question of trade-offs, right? There's not kind of a armchair philosopher, this is the correct age. I think that something similar could be true. How do we think about how the economy impacts family formation and family sustenance, not just the forming of the family, but the sustaining of the family? And are there certain economic practices where we want to consider what those trade-offs are? And then I just think we get into an empirical discussion. And, one of those things is going to be that we don't know, we can't know, as you point out, all of the things that we are trading off. And then I think the next step is, but does that just mean that we don't even engage in that process? Do we say that, because that there are certain things that we can't know, the only proper response is going to be a hands-off response? Or does that just mean it's a challenging policy-making situation? We do the best we can. Has the gig economy been a net benefit or a net cost for low wage workers? Right? I mean, I think that's an empirical question that, you know, we should investigate. And then we shouldn't say, because it's a hard question, the only appropriate response is a hands-off approach. It's, you know, going in knowing that there are going to be trade-offs and that we can't account for all of them. What does that then look like?
Well, I agree completely. And I think, and I, where I probably am different than a lot of my more libertarian leaning right-wing friends is I find a great deal of benefit in having the conversation. And first of all, developing some consensus about what some of the issues are we want to address. And then from there, the harder work of developing solutions. I don't think if I made a list of the 15 things that I feel are most ethically, not even just ethically, because I don't want to imply a wrongdoing, but for the cause of human flourishing that are creating the biggest deficits in that cause. If I made a list of the top 15, I would be very surprised if very many or any next to that list of problems in the solution column had Washington, D.C. written down. But that's not the same as saying that there's no role anywhere for federal government. The child labor law issue you speak to, I am in 100% agreement. It was a legitimate function of government. But even then, I believe it was a state and local and ought to have been there. I don't think there's any constitutional jurisdiction for the federal government to have played a role there. Right now, today, we have states where legal working age is 14, some where it's 15, some 16, some 18. There's different requirements on what permits are involved. And I think it would be really problematic to think of Washington, D.C. as setting those regulations. But I think we all accept that different counties or states may have their own. But ultimately, what I appreciate about what Orrin's doing and others in this situation with the gig economy and with the plight of working class America is having the discussion around where there may be policy solutions that could be more useful. So I'm very sympathetic to the work that a lot of people on the right were critical of 10 years ago, guys like Ross Douthat, Ryan Salam, and Yuval Levin, Ramesh Panuro. I think that in some of the particular cases, I didn't happen to agree. I thought that there was enough of a lack of limiting principle. I was worried about where it could go, but I appreciated the effort. My concern, Ryan, is right now, I think that the other side is they may not recognize that some of the things they're stating and the way in which it's being argued, not merely covering the delta between X and Y, that they are essentially borrowing from the progressives' cries that almost everything we're saying, you could just change, keep the rhetoric, but change the subject and object. And all of a sudden you're talking about either identity politics, the welfare state. You know, it's interesting. You said earlier about maybe Medicare is working better than Medicaid, but then, you know, are we willing to throw out the economics entirely? The people may be more satisfied with the Medicare result than they are with Medicaid. I think that's right. And there's really obvious reasons for why that is. But Medicare is certainly creating the far bigger unfunded liability. So there is a sort of broken window thing going on there, the visible, invisible. It is the fact that your children and grandchildren are going to have to inherit the unfunded liability of Medicare less important to us than the fact that today a larger percentage of senior population is generally happy with their Medicare Part A treatment? I mean, there are trade-offs. I would suggest that $100 trillion unfunded liability is a pretty bad trade-off, but nevertheless, I just want us to have these agreed upon first principles. And I think when you bring up the knowledge problem is a reason why government's regulation to some of the labor conditions, I think it's really a great argument. And it's always been there since Hayek kind of codified it that way. But I still also believe in the incentive issue. And I believe in the doctrine of subsidiarity. I don't believe the government can love us. And so I don't want to set as a policy prescription any direction that is asking for a governmental entity to play the role of lover. They cannot operate from that spirit of genuine human empathy and compassion. And so I think we're stuck with the most inconvenient truth, to borrow from Al Gore imaginable, which is that the Burkean and Aristotelian objective in front of us is inescapable, that apart from policy, the great lowest hanging fruit we have is to advance a virtuous society, to advance the moral education that Yuval Levin talks about, to advance the greater role of family and church and the culture, the mediating institutions, and that to recognize the doctrine of original sin. We're not going to get this perfect, and there will still be bad things that happen. And yet, along the way, from a policy wisdom standpoint, let's look at everything, but do so still holding to conserve the notions of the liberal society that we believe in.
Sorry, that was incredibly rich. I actually took down notes because it struck at least three things that I wanted to kind of say in reaction to that. I mean, one would be, so when I mentioned earlier how Medicaid and Medicare kind of just, you know, function purely as healthcare delivery systems, I think you're entirely right to say, you know, the unfunded liability and the debt that we're passing on to our children and grandchildren. I also think there's a bigger trade-off and a moral critique of those programs. And, you know, let me add in the third one, Social Security. I think for many people of my generation, our parents and our grandparents are the government's responsibility rather than our responsibility. That one of the cultural consequences of some of those old age programs was that children, you know, adult children don't feel like they have the moral responsibility to care for their elderly parents. Yep. Now, look, it's a trade-off. We no longer have elderly poverty the way that we did, to the extent that we did prior to the introduction of these programs. On the other hand, we've institutionalized old age, and, you know, more and more senior citizens spend their last few years in nursing homes. And, you know, some of this is a technological question because we now have life sustaining treatments to an extent that we didn't have before. I mean, to my mind, the moral vision we should be looking for is as many families as possible welcoming in their parents and their grandparents to spend, you know, the last days, you know, with them in a multi-generational family. And look, it's not always possible, but I think, you know, incentivizing that, structuring things around that would be a good cultural goal. The second thought is when you said that, you know, a lot of what you're hearing from the right sounds too similar to what you're hearing from the left, and that the fear is that, you know, this is just going to be a way of getting snookered into a large, centrally planned, you know, left-leaning, you know, welfare program. I think there's another concern here, is that some of the Biden policies are more likely to become law if voters don't see a conservative alternative that speaks to their concerns. This is why I think Trump, on the rhetoric, spoke to a working class voter who had certain economic and cultural anxieties in a way that the other candidates didn't. And so if Biden's plan is going to be universal daycare and the Republican plan is nothing, I actually think we're more likely to end up with universal daycare. Whereas if the Republican plan is, you know, a tax credit to allow more moms to stay at home with their kids, or a tax credit to allow for more paid family leave, whatever, right? Something that actually empowers parents to make the choice to parent their child. That might be a better outcome than the universal daycare one that you know, the Biden plan would be pushing. And then the last thought I had was when you were commenting about your support for the child labor laws, which, you know, I'm glad we have agreement there. I wonder, you know, how would you feel? Because then you said, you know, you don't want this at a federal level, better at the state and local level. Throughout much of American history—
Unless it's an enumerated power.
Enumerated power, yeah. Throughout much of American history, states and municipalities had blue laws, Sunday closing laws. Yeah. Some still do, you know, at least as applied to alcohol, you know, no Sunday morning liquor stores, things like that. I just wonder, I mean, what is your thought in general? It raises both church-state questions because it was Sunday closing laws, but then it also raises economic concerns. I mean, is it an appropriate role of the state or a city government, state government, whatever level of government you think is appropriate, to say we want to have a uniform day of rest? We want to have a day in which the political, economic, cultural expectation is that people aren't laboring for pay. They're engaged in leisure activities. They're engaged in family activities. And the way that this is going to work best is if it's uniform. Is that an overreach of government? I mean, and just the reason I mention is that because for much of American history, we had those sorts of laws.
Well, and see, again, the laws that we've had out of, let's say you go back to the 17th century before we had a Declaration of Independence, and you looked at the kind of Puritan heritage of the country, these were out of individual colonies. There was still a sort of federalism that was embedded in the structure. And if Pennsylvania wanted to have a certain Sabbatarian respect that Delaware didn't, and if we now apply that into a more complex union of 50 states and many, many provinces or counties or what have you, I'm completely for it. And remember, Ryan, I am not bound only by my love of natural law, but also strong regard for special revelation, including scripture. And so I think that the Christianized state that flows from an organically Christianized people will voluntarily implement more Christianized views of a day of rest, of labor laws, of family protections. So we need not, in a secularized society, worry about imposing such if we get the bottom-up cultural transformation right, which for me is largely evangelistic and triumph claims of gospel and things like that. However, as a matter of economics, as a matter of good polity, having those traditions and those rules and regulations, I'm totally for. But I want them to come out of spontaneous order. I want them to come from best practice. I can think of barely anything. This is the amazing part about minimum wage laws, is that I don't believe wages would go up if we got rid of, would go down if we got rid of minimum wage laws. I think that most of the things that have advanced, and I know there's a chicken or egg here too, because we say right now you see companies that are competing in the market by offering better perks to employees. Right. And then others could say, well, yeah, they're doing that because unions and Orrin Cass and other, you know, there's been effort, even the left, there's been people to push the other side. And I think that's a legitimate argument. I don't have a great response to the idea of how far along would we be with these things if it wasn't for the other side poking away at state interventions to try to help. All I know is that I believe in free exchange. Mm-hmm. And I believe the alternative to free exchange is worse. And when we say you you will be better as a family and a community with a day of rest, and when you come work here, we will not make you work on Sundays, I think that is better for the employer and better for the employee. And all I can say is that I would take Chick-fil-A's EBITDA over almost every other fast food chain in the country. And nobody forced Chick-fil-A to close on Sundays.
Yeah.
So the freedom component to the virtue is still, I think, very legitimate. And yet I am with you and our other friends here that I want to continue screaming for. That's why Father Sirico and I constantly talk about the free and virtuous society. I'm not looking to prioritize one over the other, but one can not come in a compulsory manner. You cannot impose the virtue. And so this is where I think we run into these tensions. And yet where I think that there's just so much health in this conversation is for the Randian right to pretend we don't need to have the conversations. I'm convinced, as you just said, it will lead to more Biden policy, more statism, because we will end up leaving needs in the society unaddressed. And as has been the testimony since 1 Samuel, people will constantly pursue a more messianic view of the king if we do not do our job as individuals, families, churches, communities.
Yeah.
Anything I'm saying there uncomfortable for you?
No, I mean, I think I agree with all that. I am probably a little bit more comfortable with certain laws that would be promoting virtue. I don't think the free and virtuous society means, you know, government does the freedom and civil society does the virtue. I think probably both government and civil society needs to do both of those things.
I don't want you to get the wrong impression from me. I agree with what you just said.
Okay.
Then my point is only that from a chicken or egg standpoint, that you will get a government that promotes virtue when you have a virtuous people, and you will never get a government promoting virtue in an unvirtuous society. It cannot happen.
Right. The way I like to think about this is I look at the destruction that the Supreme Court has had, that as the Supreme Court overturned laws that we historically passed, right? So when we were a virtuous people, we passed laws protecting unborn babies. We passed laws, regulating obscenity. We passed laws limiting sexual vice. We passed laws defining marriage correctly. And one by one, the Supreme Court overturned those laws. And I think those all had a pedagogical impact, that when the court tells you, you now have a constitutional right to fill in the blank, people come to believe it, that, you know, the court can be a teacher, which then puts you in a situation in which the laws corrupted the culture. And better to be at the spot where you had both the laws and the culture supporting both freedom and virtue, which I think are necessarily interdefined, because I mean, think about it, the founders distinguished liberty from license. And, you know, what was the distinction, right? Liberty was freedom exercised under the moral law. License was freedom outside of the moral law, right? And so we could say something was a free act was a true act of liberty versus a licentious act, based upon whether or not it accorded with the moral law, the natural law, the divine law, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we've lost the ability to distinguish kind of the blessings of liberty from the abuses.
Oh, I agree completely.
And that needs to be something that both the state and civil society engage in.
We believe that whether or not you have a virtuous people, the state has to protect against the lack of morality that leads to murder, or the lack of morality that leads to theft. And there, you brought up earlier sex crimes and so forth. So the state has this function, and I have never bought into the argument that those things are not in the moral category. I think that the reason I want the criminalization of murder is because of the great woeful immorality of murder. When you go from that category to market transactions, it's not merely a difference of degree, but it also becomes a difference of kind. Now, the state still has a role in regulating some aspect of market transaction. I just think all of us would agree that it's a very small role. And when we start with a presupposition of a large role, it's hard to imagine getting to a place that upholds the virtuous society to the degree it removes responsibility from the individual citizen. Much like your argument about, which I agree with wholeheartedly, about Social Security and Medicare laws largely disintermediating kids and grandkids from the well-being of their parents. These things just have a historical record that is empirical now, that has largely shown inverse relationship between the role of government and the virtue responsibility of the citizen.
Yeah.
Ryan, we could talk about it all day. I do this every week, by the way. I tell guests 40 minutes and we go an hour or longer. And so it speaks to the fact that these are important topics that you and I both care about. And you have so much wisdom to offer here. I would really love it if you'd come back another time on Capitol Record.
I'd love it. This was a good discussion. I'm glad we are doing it.
Thanks so much, Ryan. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. You can see that where two people share an earnest and heartfelt desire to get to the right place. There can be some disagreement on the margins. There can be some gray areas that require further unpacking. And yet adherence to first principles goes a long way to not getting pulled astray altogether. And that's the need of the hour right now for those of us who want to hold on to the freedom of a free and virtuous society, and also hold on to the virtue of a free and virtuous society, that one need not sacrifice one for the sake of the other. And that's, I think, what the centerpiece of this conversation is that Ryan and I just had. It probably produces more questions than answers, but that's okay, because we're going to have another podcast and we're going to keep this conversation going. We're going to keep working and enjoying these conversations towards the aim of defense of free enterprise, capital markets, and indeed the free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to The Capital Record.